This is Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jonathan Aull. Senator Jim Bunning led a one-man crusade to hold up a number of federal programs because, in his opinion, they weren't properly funded. The Republican is a longtime maverick and party outsider, but his Mr. Smith goes to Washington-style filibuster may have significant political implications. Mitt Romney is doing all the things that people do when they want to run for president. He has a new book out, and he wants to talk to the people about his vision for America. The earthquake in Chile is getting less attention than the earthquake in Haiti, but its economic and political impact may be greater. And Governor Culver returned from his trip to Iraq to find he has a primary opponent that's already criticizing that trip. It's Politics Day, and we'll talk about those issues and more with Stefan Schmidt, political science professor at Iowa State University, and New Hampshire political analyst Arnie Arneson. We'll also take your calls and emails. Talk of Iowa is coming up after this check of news from NPR and Iowa Public Radio. This is Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jonathan Aull. It's Politics Day, and joining us this week, as every week, Stefan Schmidt, political science professor from Iowa State University. Good morning, Stefan.
Good morning.
And Arnie Arneson, New Hampshire-based political analyst, is on the line as well. Arnie, good morning to you.
Good morning. I sent you a note, and I asked if I could start the show with almost a point of personal privilege.
Yes, and provided you get in sure. Some comment on Iowa being one of only two states in the nation that has yet to send a woman to Congress, the Senate, or to its governor's
well,
office.
See, this isn't bad because a couple of things. One, it's Women's History Month, so I wanted to let everyone know that. And two, there was an amazing article in the New York Times by David Brooks called The Hard and the Soft, and it's about this remarkable Norwegian named Jan Balsrud. And I recommend that everyone read it. He's sort of commenting on the Olympics, but then he goes into this remarkable Norwegian who manages to survive the Nazis. And as I'm reading David Brooks, and I'm realizing it's Women's History Month, I need to let you know what I did this just yesterday. Yesterday, I went to the funeral of a woman who died over the weekend, and she was a survivor of the Holocaust. And her name was Gitel Gerzon. And I want to read you just two or three paragraphs because it's so important to me, because history isn't just what we write, Jonathan. It's what is lived. And since this is Women's History Month, and if David Brooks can write about the Nazis and Jan Balsrud, Arnie Arneson can tell a story about Gitel Gerzon. So this is, and it's also important because women have not necessarily gotten to higher office in Iowa. Well, maybe we need to find more Gitels to understand that this is what life and women are made of. And Gitel is talking to her daughter, her granddaughter, just before she dies. And her granddaughter, of course, is very curious about this amazing woman who survived and lost all her family in Poland with the Nazis. And she asks her grandmother, and the question is, this time it's about love. And I just want to read it, and I promise it'll be short. Do I love him? What do you mean, love him? He's a headache, that's what he is. He's a fool, I'd be happier without him. But it was different then, not like today. Now you ask someone to have a coffee, next thing you know, you're playing around in bed. I'm sure you've seen it on television, what's going on. Love, it's nothing today. Cheap. Anyway, enough. You asked me, do I love him? Love. If you're talking romance, getting googly-eyed, this I never experienced. Things were different. And during the war, forget it. No one there was looking for love. People were losing mothers and fathers, babies, aunts, uncles, you name it. My brother died. I think I told you. He was a sick boy always, bad kidneys. But it was his mind that killed him. Just lost hope. From the moment we said goodbye to our father at the edge of the forest, Gedalia had already given up. We're going to die here. We're never going home, he'd say. Even before they put us on the barge to Siberia, before we had to work, he was talking like this. I couldn't believe those things, so I just took care of him the best I could. He got so thin, and his eyes looked like an old man's. I gave him the crust of my bread and stayed with him as long as I could at night to help him fall asleep. But all he really needed was some hope, and that I couldn't give. Before he died, he told me I had to find a man to take care of me. Even when he was withering away and could hardly walk himself to the latrine, I still listened to his every word. After all, he was my older brother. What do you want? That one, he said, about your grandfather. He's the only dependable one here. The others, don't let them near you. But this guy, he's okay. He saw that Gershon had a camera and would be able to make some money taking pictures. I myself didn't think he was anything special to look at. After all, he had a big nose. I was even taller than him. Even today, see, he's a little man. You see him. Imagine me, younger than you, no family, so skinny I could count my ribs. They only gave us watery soup and stale bread, and there was more sawdust than bread. I had no one. I was just a girl. It was just so hard. I don't like to think about it. You want some Coca-Cola? All right, I'll try to tell you more for you. You know I never talk to nobody. It gives me bad dreams when I sleep. But for you, dear, anything. You came with your recorder machine and want to hear my story? So I'm going to talk. Maybe someday you'll write a beautiful novel about my life. It could make some money, you know, like Judy Collins. Well, what can I say? I had no one after Gedalia died. So I married your grandfather. Love? I don't know what that means. Anyway, this amazing woman died over the weekend, and she gave birth to four remarkable children. She has five amazing grandchildren. Her life is the survival story. And maybe the reason I wanted to start with this is that we're all feeling so damn sorry for ourselves, and we think we can't fix health care, and we're angry at the banks, and we want Wall Street to protect Main Street, and we want Barack Obama to lead and find a spine. And I just want to remind you that there are some people who face such incredible adversity and manage to survive and come through. And I just want us all to think about that, because in the end, the best of politics reminds us what it is that we have in the way of choices. So there you go.
How do we go on from that? It kind of marginalizes everything.
God. It just,
that's all the time we have for a talk about
sorry,
it today. The show is produced by...
Oh, no. It was such a beautiful funeral.
No, it is. It is.
I had to share it with you because I kept realizing she has survived so much, and we are complaining, and we have such opportunity. We're just afraid to make a change. Oh, my God. Get a life.
Well, we have in some respects, at least, I think, Jonathan and Arnie, paid a very heavy price for excessive prosperity and for the fact that we never saw the need to think about, well, what do we do when that slows down? You know, it seemed unlimited and endless, and we could become hyper-individualistic because there was so much to go around that we could all live in an apartment, a single person at a time, and have all of the appliances and utilities and games and other things just for ourselves and drive in one person in a car to go somewhere because the system made it possible. And we have not gone through the Great Depression, and we didn't even go through the Great Recession because we have so much underpinning to come along and try to at least take some of the sting out of it. My students would not understand that story, Arnie, that you just read. They just wouldn't understand it.
And that's why I want people to go to the David Brooks piece. It was the most emailed piece in the New York Times. And here's David Brooks, the political writer, Jonathan, who's writing about this remarkable Norwegian because he's watching the Olympics and realizing that the Americans are waxing poetic about how many gold medals they won. And yet Norway, you know, the size of a suburb, wins almost as many gold medals. And he says, but look what the Norwegians are. Look what they're made of. And that's the piece just this week. I mean, I think it was yesterday in the New York Times. And I just want to somehow give us perspective back. And I say that also in light of the fact that the Supreme Court just heard a court case this week about whether we can restrict guns, okay? And, of course, people were flying in from all over the country so they can get a front row seat. And I'm sure all of them were so upset because they had to leave their ammo outside the courtroom. But I'm thinking, isn't this ironic? They want to make sure that they can pack heat in any kind of a setting, whether it's, you know, restricted or not, because this is their right. And so we want a right to kill, but we don't want a right to live because we can't figure out health care.
Well, or
it's
you want
ironic.
A right to defend yourself so that you're not killed, Arnie. You know,
well,
I mean,
no,
if the Jewish people have still not recovered, and my mother was Jewish, so pardon me putting a little footnote in here. They still haven't recovered from the fact that they basically didn't fight back. Some of them did, you know, there were the uprising in the ghetto in Warsaw and so on, but they still can't get their hands around the fact that they just sat there and let themselves be taken to the ovens, and they had no guns, they weren't armed, they weren't prepared to protect themselves, they were totally essentially the victims of their trust in the society. And
so
many Americans would like to be able to protect themselves because there is, in fact, a great undercurrent of crime and violence in this country. And the law enforcement agencies, Arnie, are really not there so much to protect us from crime as to clean up after it and find the perpetrator. And, you know, I have friends in Phoenix, Arizona. Apparently you can't go downtown Phoenix anymore because it has become such a crime-ridden place. And so,
can we make a deal? You know, here's the deal. If you can carry a weapon and by mistake you shoot me, then I want to make sure I have the health care to take care of myself when I get shot by mistake. I mean, I'm just going to say, you want to protect and I want to live. And if you want to protect, then we should talk about that right. But there should also be a right to live. And I think that's a quality of life question. I think that's a right question. I think that's really what this whole healthcare debate is a lot about. And it's, to me, so surprising because as I'm watching people fly in this decision about a weapon, I keep thinking, why aren't people flying in about whether they can go to a doctor when they're sick?
Well, Arnie, if I ever shoot you, I can guarantee there is an emergency room that'll come, and I'm a pretty good shot, so I'll try to hit you, you know, on your little pinky or something.
All these things start, you know, percolating because look at all the issues that get people so excited, and yet at the same time, we can't get the financial regulation to get our markets back straight. We can't figure out health care, even though we know that it's breaking the back of business and making us uncompetitive. But when it comes to whether you can carry a weapon in Chicago, people are flying in from all over the United States to sit in the front row to make sure the Supreme Court is being eyeballed, because the likelihood is the Supreme Court will agree with the NRA. And they will say that, you know, this right, you know, basically trumps the right of many cities and states to make any kind of regulation. It's pretty interesting times.
Well, to what extent, though, is those ideological discussions, regardless of where you fall on that issue, more telling of your priorities than addressing something that is by nature cyclical, like the economy?
Yeah. Well, and there is, how do I say this? There's an incredible passion when it comes to the Second Amendment, that is not, there's nothing that comes even close to it. Isn't it remarkable? I mean, I kept thinking that the abortion fight, the gay marriage fight, but the thing that actually trumps that fight, Jonathan, is the Second Amendment. I've come to somewhat appreciate it because I will tell you a really quick story. One day I was doing my talk show and some guy called in. We were having a discussion about gun control and one of the White Mountain Militia, okay, a member of the White Mountain Militia was calling my show and we were having this discussion about weapons. And at the end of the show, all of a sudden I get this knock on the door because I have to go to the bathroom and my producer said, don't come out of the John.
Okay, we're going to have to pick it up from there. We'll have to go with the suspense because we've got to go to break right now.
Oh, no.
We will pick it up with Arnie and the knock at the door right after this break on Talk of Iowa. We'll take your emails and phone calls as well, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org or 866-780-9100. Phone number and email to call. More of Politics Day on Talk of Iowa after this break here on Iowa Public Radio. This is Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jonathan Aull. Stephen Schmidt and Arnie Arnesen are our guests for this Wednesday Politics Day. And Arnie, we cut you off in the middle of a suspenseful story.
Don't hate me, Jonathan. Don't hate me.
There was a knock at the door.
You're sitting there going,
he's
a lunatic. This is a novel. All right, so wait a minute. So I'm having this discussion with a guy from the White Mountain Militia on my little radio station. And I go to the bathroom at the end of my show, and my boss comes out and says, don't leave the bathroom. I go, why? He said, Pittsfield is here with his guns. And I went, oh, my God. But I've been talking to this guy for 2 years on the radio, and I said, I think it's okay. I'm coming out. And what had he done? He had traveled almost 20 miles to the radio station to show me his guns, not to hurt me, not to do anything to damage, but they were so important, and he felt that I was coming from a place of ignorance. And I needed to understand better. And it was kind of out of respect that he came to bring them to me so I would have a better understanding. And exactly what you said, Stefan, he didn't want only the government to have the guns. He said exactly what you said about the Holocaust, that he didn't want to go into the night without having the ability to fight back. That's exactly what he said. The problem is we're talking about a handgun law in the city of Chicago where a bulge in a pocket is so different than a bulge in a pocket in Nevada, Iowa, okay, where people are much more afraid, where it's much more dense, where it's much more lethal, and that's why I don't know which side I'm on.
Well, I watched the CNN coverage on this, and actually I'm planning to show it to my students because the interview had both the woman in the neighborhood who got the city to essentially pass a stricter gun regulation. But they also had an African-American older gentleman who said, look, he said, this is a really, really dangerous place. He said, I want to have a gun in my house because if these guys come in here and break in here, I want to be able to defend myself. And so the argument was clearly, and these were all minority folks, to say when only the street gangs have weapons, and most of them are obtained illegally anyway, so a gun control law means nothing to drug gangs. You know, they buy them across the border, and there are all kinds of illegal guns around. Then it is, in fact, true that you become the helpless victim because everybody that shouldn't have guns has them, and you don't. And people are reluctant to break into somebody's house if they think, you know, grandma has got a .357 Magnum with a really large clip, you know, of hollow points sitting right on her bedside table. And if I go in there, I'm probably going to come out with a lot of holes in me. So there is, you know, the more dangerous the place is, the more the good people need guns. And I know because I grew up in a country where gun control was absolute. You were not allowed to own a gun unless the government, the military, issued you a permit. That was Colombia, South America. You were not allowed to buy a single bullet unless you went to the government munitions store with a permit and bought it from the military. Yet everybody had guns, and my father armed all of us. My mother had a gun. I had a gun when I was starting at age 12. My dad had several guns. And when we went to our ranch in the Andes Mountains, we slept with those under our bed. My dad always had one tucked into a holster under his armpit because it was a dangerous place. There were all kinds of bandidos running around holding up farms and ranches and so on. So I can sympathize with people who do not trust the official law enforcement agencies because they can't be there when somebody comes to harm you, you know, and the ultimate line of defense is your trigger finger on your gun, you know, and if you don't have that ability, they can come and take you away in a body bag and do an investigation. But I can see the point.
Let's try to take a call. Todd from Davenport is on the line. Todd, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I appreciate the opportunity to that you're bringing this up on NPR. My question is, actually my statement is, I think we're missing an opportunity to have a dialogue about this Supreme Court case because what everybody keeps talking about is whether or not the courts are going to allow this or allow that. And I keep hearing the word give rights or give us the right to do this. When in fact, the Bill of Rights are all about are the shall nots. The fact that we have a right as an individual, naturally, inalienable right to defend ourselves, to bear arms before the construct of the Constitution was ever penned, and that the Bill of Rights actually says the government shall not infringe on those rights, versus this dialogue about whether or not the courts are going to allow this or that. We've gone down this rabbit hole over the last couple hundred years where we think that the government gives us our rights, and they do not. In fact, Senator Harkin, in a recent statement, talked about health care reform, and he even said out loud that, you know, we are making legislation which is giving people rights. That's completely antithetical to the entire construct of the way the Constitution was put together.
Well, I think that what the Supreme Court does is it clarifies those rights in light of, you know, 250 years having passed. And so it's there to act as a referee, and I think the direction it's going, wouldn't you agree, is to wind back some of the restrictions that have been put on what you're referring to as a kind of natural right. That's what people think is the court is saying, wait a minute, you require people to have driver's licenses. The people who rode horses and buggies were not required to go down and take a buggy riding test and get a photo ID. But when you're driving a 16-wheeler or you're driving a vehicle, you may need to know a little bit more about the rules of and so on. And with guns, you know, when you're living in 2010, you may have to have some things done a little bit differently from, you know, 1800 or 1700. And I think the court is there to make sure that we're not doing more than is necessary in order to validate those principles that are in the Constitution.
So where does
for example,
the principle of life come in? The principle of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And I guess I'm going to look at healthcare from the perspective of the term life. You know, if the pursuit of happiness and life and liberty, if liberty is a gun, then what's life?
Well, I think
I guess so. It's funny because we can sort of pick and choose what we think is innate, what comes before, and I think the opportunity to have us all sort of care for each other, and whether it was the medicine man or the physician or the whatever, every society has gone to someone or found someone who could be the healer, and that was part of the pursuit, not just of happiness but of life. And isn't that part
the only,
of
the only question is, Arnie, who should pay for it, isn't it? I mean, you can go to a doctor. You know, right now, you can go to a doctor, and if you don't have any health insurance whatsoever, they'll bill you. And if you don't have a red nickel to your, or I guess a red penny to your name, very likely it'll be written off and somebody else will pay for it. I mean, you know, so it's just not a very good system because it burdens those of us who are carrying very big, expensive health insurance policies, and it burdens hospitals. You should listen to the people at the Iowa Hospital Association, where I gave my keynote speech last week. They were truly worried about the fact that, you know, that their expenses are going up so much, their liability insurance is up so much, and so on. So, you know, we do have health care in this country, Arnie. It's not as though this is Haiti.
Well, and you, those philosophical issues, I mean, Arnie, I think you like expand on this point that do we have different discussions about philosophical issues when there's a price tag involved than when we don't? Because you can talk about issues where both sides feel very passionate, like gun control or abortion or the death penalty. And those, because there aren't a lot of real direct costs related, the tenor of the discussion's a lot different.
Well, but there are costs to guns, and it's not just the cost of the weapon you buy at Walmart. There are consequences to guns, whether we see it when a shooting happens in a high school, whether we see it when there is no question, when you make sure that you have eroded public services. And that's the first responder, the firefighter, the cop, the beat cop, the whatever it is. I mean, and when you see those things happening, you obviously have then said to people, well, we have abandoned the public trust, the sense that the public will be protected. So therefore, the only thing you have left is to protect yourself. And that's because we have basically begun to, I mean, there is no question that when you see people walk in the streets and you have cops walk in the streets and knowing the small businessman and knowing the school teacher and knowing the kids that are in that neighborhood, the neighborhood is safer. When those cops disappear, that safety
but
disappears.
Arnie, those are still the kind of the abstract philosophical sociological costs. Stephen, do you think there's a different debate had when the discussion is completely ideological and doesn't need to have a companion funding bill with it on any issue?
Well, it tends to be different because, you know, there is this in the United States, there is this very strong feeling that it's my money that's being used for something I don't agree with. And so people very often are upset by that. That's why publicly funded abortions went away, because people said abortion is a sin and a crime and I don't want my tax money used for it. And the system said, okay.
Todd from Davenport, thank you very much for your call. We'll have more on Talk of Iowa after this break with Stephen Schmidt and Arnie Arneson. This is Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio.
The president proposes cash for caulkers. This is the Environment Report. I'm Lester Graham. President Barack Obama is pushing for a new federal program that would create a cash for clunkers-like rebate for people who make energy-saving home repairs. Orlando Montoya covered the president's announcement.
The program would be called HomeStar. In it, homeowners would be eligible for up to $3,000 in rebates if they hire someone to seal up their attic, install new windows, or make other repairs to cut down on home energy use. The president made his announcement at a community college in Savannah, Georgia. In the audience were contractors that he said could do some of the energy-efficient work.
These are companies ready to take on new customers. Their workers eager to do new installations and renovations, factories ready to produce new building supplies. All we've got to do is create the incentives to make it happen.
Administration officials say the program could cost $6 billion. Mr. Obama wants the Homestar program included in a jobs bill being drafted by Congress. For the Environment Report, I'm Orlando Montoya.
This program would be different from the tax credits given right now because it would mean rebates when you buy insulation at the store or contract for services. This is the Environment Report. Well, besides billions for energy savings, in recent weeks, President Obama has also been suggesting we start building nuclear power plants again. He announced loan guarantees to kickstart construction of the first new plants in 30 years.
I have to build a new generation of safe, clean nuclear power plants in America.
The nuclear industry likes the idea of new plants, but Sean Ali reports it's just as interested in keeping old nuclear power plants going for decades longer.
Run a reactor, you have to have the federal government's okay. That lasts for 40 years, and if you want to keep running for another 20 years, you have to ask for a license renewal. And a lot of companies do ask, because it's far cheaper to run an old reactor than it is to build a new one, even with federal help. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission, or NRC, evaluates those renewal requests. In the past decade, it's approved 59 renewals. That's for more than half the existing fleet. This is too fast for critics.
We haven't been happy with the process, and I think that there are issues associated with license renewal, and the NRC needs to address those.
That's Edwin Lyman. He's a physicist with the Union of Concerned Scientists, an environmental group. Lyman worries the NRC downplays risk from old reactors, things like corrosion in the reactors and aging pipes that leak radioactive water. Leaks have occurred in at least 27 reactors. Some had already gotten their licenses renewed. But the NRC says Lyman and other critics shouldn't worry about aging reactors. Samson Lee oversees renewal applications at the NRC. He says old reactors meet the same safety standards new ones do. Plus, companies have to show they'll manage aging parts.
So if they continue to meet the requirement to ensure the plants are safe, and if they continue to meet that, then, you know, we can issue a renewal license.
The NRC and its critics will have plenty of opportunities to fight over reactor license renewals. The government expects to evaluate 37 more renewal applications over the next decade. That's far more than the applications it's received for new reactors. And if they get the okay, these old reactors will stretch their lives for at least another 20 years.
Tomorrow, Sean will have a report on one state that has said no to renewing a nuclear power plant's license. That's the Environment Report. I'm Lester Graham.
Support comes from the Park Foundation, the Gaylord and Dorothy Donnelly Foundation, and the Great Lakes Fishery Trust. You can find more information and post your comments at environmentreport.org. The Environment Report comes from the University of Michigan.
This is Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. Our guests this morning, Arnie Arneson and Stefan Schmidt, Politics Day, taking your calls and emails. Talk of Iowa at iowapublicradio.org or 866-780-9100. Talking about gun control and health care has dominated most of the conversation in the first half. Let's continue with that theme. Bob from Des Moines is on the line and has a comment. Bob, welcome to Talk of Iowa.
Hi, thank you very much for taking my call. I love Wednesday. I always look forward to it. I think there's something that's been kind of lost in the debate about guns versus illegal guns and legal guns. And I think the best example of it is the gentleman that has brought the case to the Supreme Court is, you know, a septuagenarian, I think. And, mm-hmm. you know, if you would ask him when he was a kid how easy it was to get a gun on the streets of Chicago, I think he would have said it would have been impossible. And that in the mid to late 80s, there was just an explosion of legal handguns, and that's what has created the illegal market.
Steph, Arnie?
So what do we do with that? I mean, the problem is that, you know, we have these instant checks, but the instant checks don't apply to gun shows. And you've got all these incredible loopholes, and the loopholes now are being mined for all they're worth. And so when is a rule a rule? When is it not a rule? It's when the loophole is bigger than the rule, and that's part of the problem. How come we have so much illegal activity vis-a-vis guns if ostensibly on paper we've clamped down on that, and the reverse has turned out to be the case? And that's part of our dilemma. Then why don't we just say there are no rules? Because in some ways we've created this market which I think inflames situations like the situation we've been talking about in many of the inner cities, where it's very easy to get a hold of a gun, no matter what kind of controls you put on it.
Well, the other problem is you could ask that gentleman, how easy was it to get crack cocaine, methamphetamine, a whole plethora of illegal drugs in the days when he was growing up? And he would have probably said, it was, you could get them, but the mafia kind of controlled everything. And if somebody misbehaved, they whacked them. And so the streets were pretty safe because the mob didn't really want to have a lot of that going on. You know, you could buy this stuff and you could buy illegal liquor, too. I mean, that's the problem is that we have not, in fact, increased law enforcement proportionately to the accessibility of either guns or drugs. In most places, there just aren't enough cops. We have restricted police activities for understandable reasons, but people are not as afraid of police as they used to be, perhaps, because of all kinds of procedures and so on. People get arrested and go to jail. They usually get off after a while because, you know, our jails are too full. So, you know, we have a disintegration of the social, moral fiber of our society, which, you know, Democrats ought to be talking about that more as well. You know, the Republicans and conservatives talk about that a lot. But, you know, when the society around you is crumbling, then things like this begin to happen where people do not trust the established authorities any longer. And my understanding was, if you go a little bit further back than the gentleman who filed the case, the United States was an extremely violent country where, you know, you had to go out and get a mean, badass sheriff to come to your town because the bad guys were constantly shooting the place up and you know, rustling cattle. And the United States was a frontier country, and guns and weapons were, for better or worse, a huge part of that, you know, cultural experience. And I think it's just become urbanized now.
Jeff from Rock Island emailed in a comment saying that Americans can't be trusted to not drive a vehicle safely, i.e. texting while driving and other distracted driving. How can Americans be trusted to own guns without limited restrictions?
And let me just remind you that when they put in the Second Amendment, it was a musket. I'll give you every musket you want. You know how long it takes to load a damn musket? I mean, I hate to say that. Do you think the framers understood an AK-47 or an M-16 or whatever it is, or pretty soon it'll be a personal atomic device? I mean, times have changed. Sophistication has changed. The number of people you can kill with a weapon has changed. So then the question becomes, how reasonable is it to assume that everyone who, you know, can walk and talk and is over the age of whatever the age is should be able to carry this kind of a weapon? And, Stefan, it's not just that the cops are not available to enforce. If there are such huge loopholes in the law, there ain't a law. There are no restrictions. Because if I go to a gun show and bite it, then guess what? Then the rules don't apply.
Well, also, Jonathan, the fellow who just emailed you, let's ask Arnie this question. Many more people die in automobile accidents in the United States every year. The automobile is a much more deadly loaded weapon than firearms. What do we do about that? I mean,
well, that's Toyota. Oh, excuse me. I mean, Toyota is now suffering the consequence. It may have to have an override now on its braking and gas system. I mean, but think about it. You have to have a license. You have cops. You have 65 miles an hour. You have seat belts. We have over and over and over again tried to marshal, you know, the finest technology to try to make this safer, recognizing that this is a cost-benefit analysis. You know that as well as I do, Stefan, that we had to make a decision on how fast we wanted to go, how far we wanted to travel, how many goods we wanted to bring to the market, and we decided that there were going to be consequences to that, but to the best of our ability, we were going to try to modify those consequences by ensuring some level of safety, not that you're not taking a risk, but we wanted to lower that risk. What's the purpose of a gun? Does it get me to work? Does it bring a product home? Tell me what it does. Does it get me to school? What does a gun do?
Well, for a lot of people, look, a lot of my friends, I don't go hunting anymore, but a lot of people love to go hunting. And in fact, hunting is coming back, and there was a wonderful piece on this very radio station and on this terrific Iowa Public Radio about sort of yuppies and urban types and so on who are now getting in touch with their food again. Did you hear that one? It was terrific because what are they doing? They're buying local vegetables. They're buying local fruit. Oh, and also they're going out and shooting animals to bring back to eat them so that they get closer to where the source of their food. I mean, if you didn't hear it, you should Google it because it was terrific. A lot of people love to hunt. Other people love to do target practice. I mean, did you see, you know, some of those Norwegians and others, they do cross-country skiing, they lie on the ground, they shoot a target, they do more cross-country skiing, they lie and they shoot. People like to shoot skeet. I used to go up to our farm with my dad.
I'm going to limit weapons to the Olympics.
I used to go up on our farm. We used to shoot every Sunday, my dad and I had a whole row road built into the side of a big red clay hill that was behind our farmhouse in the Cordillera Occidental near Cali. And on the little road, I had all my little matchbox cars. The ones that were falling apart, my dad and I would sit, you know, 100 yards away, and we'd shoot them out of the off the little road. And it was great fun, and it was a you know, dad and son kind of thing to do. Then we would take those guns, we'd reload them, and we would put them under our bed and make sure that if people raided our farm, and in Colombia, when they raid your farm, they kill you. They slice your throat and kill you, and they rape the women. That we would at least be able to fend them off and possibly deter them from doing it because they could hear that we had guns because we did target practice every Sunday. So there are lots of reasons why people have always, throughout the history of humanity, since they finally progressed from clubs and spears to after they invented gunpowder to guns, people have always had them, enjoyed them, used them, often misused them, you know. But it's like everything else. We, you know, they are part of the human experience and culture. And, you know, we have a valid and vital and vibrant argument here about them. And we're never going to, this is like abortion, you know, we're never going to settle this one because people have very different opinions about it.
Except Arnie is now on record for being in favor of unlimited proliferation of muskets and biathlon rifles.
That's right. Exactly.
We have a couple of emails this that I want to get to here. Laurent from Ames writes, Stefan's story about his father arming the family members reminded me of Alabama State Senator Ray Burgess, is it? This is not in my realm of history, but who insisted it was a constitutional right to carry a gun everywhere, even in the House chamber. As he was an aggressive, stubborn man, this made his colleagues very nervous. They tried to dissuade him from brandishing his gun during legislative sessions. Burgess also armed his wife and children and taught them all how to shoot. Before Burgess ever got so angry that he shot a colleague, his wife got angry with him one day and shot him to death with the gun that he'd given her. And that ended the story of Ray Burgess.
Well,
there you go, Arnie. And you know, if more women, this is Women's Week, Arnie. Let's just talk about this. Spousal abuse is a huge problem in this country. We need to arm women. And in fact, the single largest purchasers of firearms in the United States, and I saw that statistic not long ago, is who, Arnie?
Women.
Yeah,
and that's not the answer.
Arnie, we've got an email that has a question for you here.
All right.
Jim from Tipton writes in, he's wondering what restrictions ought there to be for his 15-year-old daughter to carry a handgun. He reports that his daughter is attractive, athletic, and I'm just going to read the email as it goes here. He may invent a term, very rapeable. Shouldn't she be allowed to carry a gun and defend herself from this violent crime, or are such rights as originally offered only for white males over 21 who own property?
Well,
that's from
great,
Jeff
then.
And Tipton.
So now now what we have is we're going to have the pretty exception. So if you've got cleavage, you can carry a gun, but if you're a dog, how lucky. I mean, look where we're going with this conversation. Is this and Stefan, you are so wrong. I understand domestic violence. And I know a lot of women now who are in jail because, in fact, after years and years of domestic violence, they shot their husband and they went to jail as a result.
And that shouldn't happen, Arnie. If I were a legislator, I would completely extend the right to self-defense to people to defend themselves within their families. Most violence in the United States doesn't occur on the street. It occurs in the family. So, yes, I would extend that right over there as well.
And we as a society have to talk about whether we want justice or revenge. And what do you get as a result of revenge? Because in the end, the weapon is very useful because it is about revenge. It's very effective for the moment. The question, is it effective for a society? Is it effective over the long term? What does it resolve? And those are just part of the questions that we never get to talk about, Jonathan. But I hate to do this because I want to sort of slightly change the subject, because during the news break at the bottom of the hour where you talked about the environment, you talked about weatherization and cash for caulkers. You have to call Senator Grassley and have him come on your show, Jonathan, because he is very upset. And you know why he's upset? He's upset because we had all this money for weatherization in the stimulus bill, and we haven't spent hardly any of it. And he's sitting there going, you want to do cash for caulkers? You can't even do damn weatherization with the stimulus money. Give me strength. So there are so many. I mean, this is the problem. We've got so many issues in front of us, and you don't know what's real, and you don't know what's Memorex. But I kind of agree with Grassley. How could we have had all this money for weatherization and then not spend it? If we're so concerned about global warming, we're worried about creating jobs, we want to help the poor, we want to make sure that efficiency happens, and even when the money was streaming out of the federal government, we couldn't figure out how to make it stick for families that need it this winter. Unbelievable.
That's why bureaucracies are so frustrating. Did you happen to see my piece, two pieces, a video and a short article in InsiderIowa.com on Chile? What was the first thing President Bachelet did after the earthquakes? Okay. She suspended all of the normal rules and declared an emergency. And I saw her interviewed in Spanish, and she said, porque los problemas de la interrupción de la burocracia, and she's talked about how all of the bureaucratic rules would slow down a rapid response for, addressing the crisis that had occurred. I mean, bureaucracy is deliberately designed to be incredibly slow, incredibly, you fill out 1,000 forms, you have to justify things, you have to have accountability. And that is what hurt New Orleans, as you remember.
But
I put Stephen, that in my piece
Stephen,
too.
Stephen, isn't suspension of rules in the name of getting something done, isn't history littered with societies where that was the first step to some kind of dictatorship or fascism or some other kind of government that was decidedly not a democracy?
Yes, but there's also the example of New Orleans where the rules were not suspended. Therefore, there was a fight between the city of New Orleans, the state of Louisiana, and FEMA over who had the principal authority to quickly respond at the beginning of the emergency. They never could get it straightened out, and when they finally did, it was too late, and the feds couldn't do what they had to do. Remember General Honoré? Remember that fabulous guy? He said, this is ridiculous. Then after the emergency, then what? Then the city was damaged. There were cars floating around. There was a ton of toxic garbage. You know what? They couldn't dispose of any of it. Why? Because FEMA was in the way and the EPA. Every disposal of the debris and damage from Hurricane Katrina was simmering and festering in New Orleans because nobody could move it, because the rules of the Environmental Protection Agency said all that stuff is toxic. It has to be disposed of according to the toxic waste management rules. Well, that would have been impossible. It was such a gigantic amount. That's fine in a small environment. So they finally had to actually suspend the EPA rules.
There's an answer for this problem. There's an answer for these problems, Stefan. And the answer for these problems is that there should be some understanding of coordination. You don't get rid of the rules. You anticipate the problem. You coordinate the response. That doesn't mean that rules aren't necessary. That doesn't mean that rules don't have a place. It means that you coordinate your response. The failure of New Orleans was the failure of coordination, that they did not know that these kinds of things happen in New Orleans. Get real. This has happened in the past. It'll happen in the present, and it will happen in the future. The question is, how do you anticipate, how do you coordinate, and how do you make sure, to the best of your ability, there is a seamless response? Why have a democracy? Because democracies are always going to be facing a crisis. The question is, can you anticipate it, and can you coordinate it for it?
It was a failure of jurisdiction. No one knew who would have what jurisdiction where, and it was a legal problem. And, when times are normal, you can build all kinds of nice bureaucratic rules about what you do and what you don't do and what you can't do. But when there is a crisis and all of a sudden things collapse around you, those rules were written for completely different circumstances. And you can't have rules operating when circumstances have changed. In Germany, the Germans love trees. I've told this story at some point before. When World War II came around, Berlin had the most beautiful boulevard called Unter den Linden. And the Linden were Linden trees. They were fabulous. The city loved them. And in Germany, to cut down a tree is like cutting off somebody's limb. Well, guess what happened in the midst of World War II when they ran out of fuel? They had no more coal. They were freezing to death. Yep, you're right. They cut down every single linden tree on Unter den Linden. At the end of World War II, there wasn't one left, and they used them for firewood. Why? Not because they wanted to do that, but because circumstances have changed, and the rules that had been written for normal peacetime no longer applied at all during wartime. And that's the same in Chile.
Jonathan,
in Chile, when the looting started...
He just dug his own grave, because what Stefan has just done is just proven why the Second Amendment, which envisioned a musket, the times have changed, the rules have changed, and perhaps what people think is an unlimited right under the Second Amendment, maybe it needs to be revisited.
You listen to my commentary on Chile, because I translated a late-breaking story from a Chilean radio station in which they were finally talking to the reporter. He was saying, The mob is coming. They're coming to loot the grocery stores. The people have no way to protect themselves and protect the grocery stores, and they built barricades, and they're using everything, including baseball bats, and I thought this was funny, golf clubs, to protect themselves against the mob that's coming. People were frightened to death. The military and the police weren't there, and homeowners and store owners and others were helpless because the mobs were there to take over and to basically take advantage of the collapse of government. And the normal rules for arresting people and for law and order law enforcement had to be suspended by President Bachelet, who is one of the most democratic and successful presidents Chile has ever had, because the circumstances had suddenly changed, and the normal procedures, habeas corpus and all the rest of it, was worthless. When you'd had half of a province destroyed, there were mobs looting, there were fires burning, and chaos had ensued. And so she suspended the rules because under those circumstances, you give force majeure to the state, to the authorities, in order to deal with it. And you also arm people so that they can defend themselves.
So here's the question that we have to ask ourselves as a society, as a state, as a community. At what point do you suspend the rules? What is the line of demarcation? For Chile, it was an 8.8 earthquake. For the United States, was it Katrina? At what point do you make that decision? The problem is I am so afraid that you basically dissolve democracy because you keep lowering and lowering the bar at which you think somehow you can suspend the rules, and that's where the tension lies. The tension lies in saying the rules are to be kept, and if we keep lowering the bar, then guess what? You don't have a democracy anymore, because democracies take time. Democracies mean there's accountability. Democracy means there are delays. It's not the most efficient form of governing, but it's the best thing we know how to do.
Stefan, we have an email here from Paul, who is wondering how your nostalgic look at your youth as a gun carrier in Colombia has worked out for the country and the people of Colombia. Paul goes on to say he's pretty sure that we shouldn't use Colombia as a model for how to run the U.S.
Well, what I'm saying is I regretted that we had to arm ourselves. We hated it. We didn't like it. When my grandmother's house was broken into, we called the police. They said, well, we don't have a vehicle and we don't have money for gas, so send a cab. We had to send a taxi cab to them. Colombia is a very violent country. And in Colombia, the only people who survive under those circumstances are the ones who are able to defend and protect themselves, because nobody is going to be there to protect you. It is an environmental circumstance. And my dad and I never once killed anyone. We used our guns for pleasure and for self-defense. And Colombia has among the most strict gun control laws in the world. And as I said, yet it is a country where people are armed, and that has to do with Colombia's incredibly violent history going back to the colonial period. But the point is that when circumstances are such that you cannot rely on the stable forces of society to be there to guarantee your safety, what do? You move away, you just sit there and wait.
Jonathan, isn't the goal then of all of us together collectively as a government, as a conversation on the radio, is to figure out what are the investments we need to make to ensure that stability? Is it a job? Is it health care? Is it a government we can trust? Think about all those things that lead to a stable society. Not that there won't always be disruption and, you know, nature won't take its course with a hurricane or some kind of major, you know, problem. But the question then becomes, what is it that we can do to contribute to change that conversation that Stefan was talking about and create the kind of stability that really grows a country?
Stefan Schmidt, Iowa State University political science professor, and Arnie Arneson, New Hampshire-based political analyst. Steph, Arnie, thanks for being on the show again, as always.
Ciao.
That's all the time we have for Talk of Iowa. Our program is produced by Dennis Reese. Assistance today from Christina Sarnelli and John Pemble. Podcasting and on-demand audio of Talk of Iowa is available at iowapublicradio.org. We always welcome your comments and questions about the program. Contact us anytime at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Our theme was composed and performed by Dan Knight. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.